that we can draw out and how we can become more like God. How we as His children can follow in His footsteps, as it were, to become like Him, to understand what it is that pleases Him, and those things should please us. The things that bother Him should be things that bother us, and so on and so forth. And so this book is a wonderful book. It tells us all about redemption, every bit of it. Forward and backwards, all has to do with the cross and redeeming mankind and God revealing Himself to us. And again, there's a reason we're here tonight, right? We're not just some big social club that decided to get together and do some funny-looking and funny-sounding things. We're here for a reason. We have a purpose. There's a purpose to everything we do here. And so one of our goals of this study is just to understand why we're here and what's so awesome and special about this thing called the church. All right, so to recap some, we've talked about the scheme of redemption being a plan that God established before creation. We've talked a lot about how it was a mystery, okay, for thousands of years. Prophecies were made, things were talked about, plans were put into place that just did not make sense to those people back then. Even many of the prophets wrote a bunch of stuff that no way on this earth they could have predicted precisely what was going to happen, as we read it in the Gospels. Okay? And we even see passages that tell us this, that, you know, they would say these things, but it was still a mystery. They were things that were spoken in a mystery. Paul talked a lot about that. We've talked about how we need to view the Bible as one book, okay, with the real division not taking place between Malachi and Matthew, but rather there at Genesis 3 and verse 6. All right? The world of Genesis chapters 1 and 2 and the world of Genesis 3 to the end of Revelation are two completely and utterly different worlds. Drastically different. World of Genesis 1 and 2 is a world that you and I can only dream about. And even then, our dreams would fall short of how good it was. Okay, I've said in here that it was essentially heaven materialized, if you will. It was that perfect. Okay, we've talked about how Genesis 1 and 2 can be described as God in perfection, man and innocence. Okay, God spoke all this monstrosity of a creation and the universe into His existence, and He looked down and said, "It is good." And folks, when God makes something and says, "It is good," it's awesome. Okay? I've got some great children. You know, I can look at those children and I can say, "Man, they're good." Okay, but that's just coming from me, a mortal man. When the God of heaven looks down and says, "It's good," folks, it's beyond good. It's beyond what we understand to be good. Okay? It was perfect. It was everything that you and I would dream of putting into a world and to make that utopian environment that we all have heard talked about and pondered about. That was it. That was the world of Genesis 1 and 2. But that was all erased and destroyed with Genesis 3:6. And we looked at a lot of passages that showed how much life changed for mankind when sin entered the earth. I mean, it drastically changed everything. And so everything that we know and hate today can all be traced back to Genesis 3 and verse 6. From natural disasters to loss of life to the illnesses that come upon us and plague us. All the hate, the violence, all the perversions that we see in this world today. Every last ounce of them, if you could walk back through and trace those back to a starting point, it would all culminate there at Genesis 3 and verse 6, and when sin entered the earth. These things did not exist prior to that. And so, Genesis 1 and 2, God in perfection, man in innocence. Genesis 3, chapters 3 through chapter 12 is the background of redemption. We've been spending several weeks here, and we'll be here for several more weeks, okay? All this is the foundation. This is the foundation of it all. It's important that we understand what goes on in these 10 chapters. Even though it's only 10 chapters, there is a wealth of information there that renders the rest of the Bible senseless if we don't grasp this. Okay, we have to understand what goes on here to even begin to make sense of the rest of the things we see written in the Bible. So we've been spending a lot of time here. We're going to be here for a few more weeks at least. We've talked about the two main lines that came from Adam and Eve, Seth and Cain. Eventually these two, you know, we have a line of righteousness and a line of evil. And eventually these two merged together through marriage. It says we see that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. They took wives, and it all just fell apart from there. And so this led to a huge disaster where every intent of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil continually. The earth was filled with violence. The earth was made corrupt. And God said, I got to do something about this. So God sets out to do what I call a divine reboot. Okay? We laugh at it, but that's true. It is. You know, you ask any... if anybody comes to me, if you know me, I'm a computer nerd. If you come to me and say, hey, Kirk, I've been having this problem with my computer, the first thing I'm going to say is, well, did you try to reboot it? Okay? Restarting it just sometimes clears out a bunch of old stuff that's running that you don't even know is running and starts over afresh. Okay? And it often kind of gets things back on track. Well, that's kind of what happened here. God set up a divine reboot, and so he set out a plan to flood the entire earth with water. He destroyed all the life on the earth, both man and animals. However, he chose to spare man and animals through a man named Noah. Now, he could have completely and utterly just ended it all right then and there, okay? But he didn't. And so many people charge God with all kinds of horrific things because of the flood. Let's face facts. The flood was a nasty thing, okay? And there's a lot of people in this world that simply do not understand that. They do not understand how this being up there who supposedly loves and cares for us and is full of compassion and all this kind of stuff, how he could do such a terrible thing. Well, we all understand the idea of justice. We do. And none of us want to live in a world where there's no justice. You talk about a terrifying place to live, you go ahead and go live somewhere where there is no law, where there is no order, where there is no punishment for things done wrong. That would just be a terrifying thing to me. Again, there's a reason we lock our doors at night, right? We understand that there are horrible things out there, and we do things to prevent those things from happening. Well, this is what was going on here. I mean, the earth had gotten into just a ridiculous state of mind. Okay, you and I haven't seen a situation like this today, where the whole world is like this. We haven't. Okay, it has not existed since the flood that I'm aware of. All right, it was bad, really bad, and God said this is enough, and so He started all over with Noah. So we talked about how God was with Noah, and God was very much involved in the flood. We see that when the flood started, it was God who closed the door of the thing. We talked about how the flood waters prevailed 15 cubits above the highest mountain, and we talked about how the ark was 30 cubits high. And in that discussion, we talked about how just the standard calculation for the draft of a boat, how deep it sinks into the water, when fully loaded, is typically half of its height. So we have a 30-cubit boat, and the waters prevailed 15 cubits above the mountain. So what we see here is precision. Okay, what we see here is the hand of God at work. We see God flooding the earth to a precise point where the ark would not hit bottom. Okay, again, we see the hand of God involved in this. God was with Noah. It's very possible that the earth as we know it today was very different from what it was in the beginning. We looked at that psalm, that passage in Psalms 104, I believe, where there's a lot of discussion there that really sounds like the flood, and how it speaks of how God made new valleys and raised up new mountains to give the water a place to go, and He has set those boundaries, and it's never going to go past those boundaries again. And so it's very different that the earth, as we know it today, just did not look like it did back then, okay? We have seven continents today. Those seven continents may not have existed prior to the flood. We don't know. All I can tell you is when we see big floods and mudslides and all that kind of stuff today, the landscape really is reorganized. And we're just talking about local floods around a river or something like that. When you talk about a global, big deal. All right, so we're going to pick up here tonight. The flood ends. We're going to be doing a lot of reading tonight, kind of like we did last week. We had several big passages, so I'm going to be asking for some volunteers. And if someone would like to start off with Genesis 8, 1 through 5.
That were with him in the ark. And God caused the wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. Also, the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed. And the rain from the sky was restrained, and the water receded steadily from the earth. And at the end of 150 days, the water decreased. In the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rest upon the mountain of Ararat. The water decreased steadily until the 10th month, and in the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the top of the mountains became visible.
Okay. So we see here at the start of this passage, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him on the ark. God remembered Noah. This word remembered here, it's not a... I forgot. They're out there floating around. It's not that kind of remember, okay? Again, we have to keep in mind, God was with Noah. He's the one that shut the door. He's the one that rose the water to such a height in protection of the ark. God was very much involved in this. Instead, this becomes from a Hebrew word. Mike, you can correct me if I pronounce this wrong, but I'm going to say Zakar. Indicates a thoughtful mindfulness. Okay, so it's kind of like you may say, ask somebody today, hey, remember me in your prayers. I'm having some struggles of some sort. If you could just remember me in your prayers, I'd appreciate it. Okay, that's what this word is getting at here. Is God had a mindful thoughtfulness about Noah and all the creatures that were on the ark, and so. God was with Noah. Again, he was with Noah, he was with his family and the animals during their voyage through the flood. Genesis chapter 8, verses 15 through 10. I'm going to guess 15 through 20, but your guess is as good as mine.
Do we have to read that one backwards?
If you want to try it, go for it, Lex. Be my guest. Somebody want to read for me?
Then God spoke to Noah, saying, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by their families from the earth.
All right. Genesis 8, verses 20 through 22.
And Noah built an altar to the Lord, and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. The Lord smelled the sickening aroma. And the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease.
Thank you. All right, so in the passage Wanda just read, we see verse 21. It says, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. Does this indicate that we are born sinful and in a lost state? Yes, no, anybody want to comment? I see a bunch of shaking heads.
A young man.
Okay.
Not a baby.
Okay. All right? Yeah, no. Rather, this is a reflection of the post-sin state of man's heart, right? And we looked at that over again in Genesis 3:6. If you remember, and over some of our studies, a lot of things changed about us when that fruit was eaten of. Okay? In Genesis 3:7, it says that Adam and Eve ate of that fruit and their eyes were opened. They realized they were naked, as we say in Alabama. All right? That's a lot different than just being naked. You naked. Okay? Their eyes were open. Okay? There was something that changed physically about them and about their understanding, about their mental capacity, something about their heart, who they were. Okay? The Bible doesn't go into a great amount of detail of exactly, well, here's what changed, here's what happened. All we know is that something changed. We changed. Our hearts changed. Do what now?
Coming teenagers,
yeah. Yeah, a lot of changes take place there, don't it? That tend to drive a lot of our behaviors.
To me, what that really said was that the young man,
yes,
has a tendency to succumb to the ways of the world.
Sure. Yeah.
And until he learns, he's not supposed to.
Correct. But when we see that in Proverbs 22:15, right? This is one of my dad's old favorite quotes, you know. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. My paddle will remove it from him. My belt will remove it from him. And the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. And we see this, you know, all of us who are parents, even if you're not a parent, you've seen it. You know?
We can't spank our kids anymore.
If you look at my belt, you might see scratch marks all over it.
We actually beg a teacher to spank our oldest boy.
Really?
She kept sending notes on saying, you know, he disrupts class, she talks too much. And he just went up there and said, please, take a paddle.
They did not spare the rod when I was in school, that's for sure. Maybe it's just my little country school out in the middle of nowhere, but they swung the paddle there. and see, there too, if you had the paddle swung on your rear at school there, well, it was swinging again when you walked through the door of the house. Especially when you're like me, who's your mother and your grandfather and your grandmother all teach at the school. And your teachers were taught by your mother or your grandfather or your grandmother or even my great-grandmother. Everybody knew when Kirk Hunt did something wrong. Emmy Hunt found out real quick. And, of course, Steve Hunt found out as soon as he got home from work. And it was not pretty for me. But, yeah, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. You know, there's just, again, something changed with us at Genesis 3:6. And we all feel it. We all know it. Folks, there is a reason that the Bible says that Satan's walking around like a roaring lion. Because every last one of us, folks, feel that in us. And you're lying if you say you don't. Okay? We are all tempted. I have seen people who I just thought were the most amazing Christians on the face of the earth succumb to all kind of great sins. As folks, we are foolish if we think that we're exempt from that. We're not. And we have to constantly be aware of that. Again, there is something in our hearts. There's this propensity, this drawn. Temptation is real. It is there. And there is no denying that. And we can't be so foolish to say that, well, you can't tempt me. I beg to differ. We feel it, folks. Every last one of us do. We understand what's being said here. All right? When God said, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, there's a reason we have to discipline our children. There's a reason we have to instruct them and say, no, 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 you can't do that. Even if not for the sake of God, just for the sake of being a good citizen and in a peaceful world. All right? We have to train, we have to teach, because there's just this natural propensity to look out for self. Self-preservation, me first. And that's something about us that we have to learn. That has to be disciplined within us. That has to change us. And Jesus spent a lot of his time teaching us that. A lot of the things that Jesus, that are talked about Jesus, things that we look to and say, man, what a savior. It's because he was putting himself last every time. He was the one down on the floor washing nasty feet. He was the one going last. And he said, if you want to be like that, you got to put yourself last. But we have this natural propensity just for self-preservation to go first, 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 me first. Whatever it takes. And so we understand that what's being said here. But God says, you know what? I'm never going to do this again. Never going to do it again. Any thoughts or comments on this? Genesis 8, verse 22. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. This was uttered by God post-flood. He gave this passage here that I will, this big one there, I will never again curse the ground. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, and a day and a night shall not cease. Now I'm going to discuss this, but please, no politics. I want to keep the political thing out of tonight's class on this, okay? But I want to talk about it. And the reason I have this big underline, please, no politics, is because the destruction of Earth is a big conversation in political arenas today.
You're talking about climate change?
You name it. Okay, climate change is one of the biggest ones we hear today. Back when I was growing up, it was the hole in the ozone layer. I mean, we hear all these things, right? And all these things, if we don't change this, if we don't change this, we're all in massive danger, all in massive danger. I'm not here to argue either way, okay? But I am here to tell us this, folks. Is it possible for man to render harm to the earth?
Absolutely.
We can't we? You go and not drop a nuclear bomb on something, it is going to render destruction. You go take a bunch of toxic material and pour it over the face of the earth, you're going to kill a bunch of things.
The Indian River.
The Indian River, sure, yeah. You know, we can render harm. We can. It's in our power to. Okay? I still remember to this day, you know, as a kid, right, you always have those, as you grow up to an adult, you know, there are just certain things that happened in your life that just changed you. You know, those certain things that happened that stores a lesson learned that you will never forget, right? A lot of them from your daddy, perhaps. All right? Maybe from your mama. Me, most of mine came from my dad, just those things that made me into the man I am, right? When I was about 11, 12 years old, I guess. Some of y'all may not understand this, but again, I grew up in rural Alabama, so you got to take it from that context. I got my first shotgun, 20-gauge, single-shot shotgun. Man, I was excited. Got it for Christmas. And a few days later, I was like, you know what? I want to go hunting. I live way out in the sticks of Alabama, Marbury, Alabama, 30 minutes from the nearest town. Had a huge hay field out in front of my house. My uncle grew and cut hay there, had cows and pens around. And so I just walked out into the hay field, saw a little bird sitting on the ground. You know, felt like a real man, right? Came in, Dad, look! Son, what'd that bird do to you? What do you mean what it do to me? It didn't do anything to me. You plan on eating that bird? No. Then why'd you kill it, son? Yeah. You know, you can see how it goes, right? That was a life lesson for me. Folks, I have never killed something in vain since that day. The only time I have taken the life of an animal since that time is if I truly intended to eat it. whether I'm deer hunting or turkey hunting, something like that, or if it was destroying my property in some way. I have not taken the life of an animal just for the sake of it since then. That was one of those critical life lessons. And so, yeah, I can go through and kill all the animals in the world that I want to, if I want. We can render harm to this earth. However,
that's
where I found out what
crow tasted like.
No, seriously. I believe you.
With my crow.
Oh man.
Literally ate crow.
Yeah. And Bill and Betty said we eat crow all the time.
Folks, I say all that to say this. Okay? God created an environment that can handle anything that we or nature throws at it. Okay? Some of you may disagree with me. Fine. Again, I'm not here to argue politics and semantics. I'm just simply here to say that God created an amazing place that is built to house us. I lost my train of thought. Chuck, you raised your hand. You made me lose my train of thought. Go ahead.
Well, the premise on where he puts it here in Genesis is while the earth remains.
Yeah.
That's a pretty strong basis because when he comes again,
yes,
he's going to destroy the creation.
Yes.
Everything. The stars, the sun, the moon, the earth, every plant, all that he created is going to be destroyed.
Yes.
It's not going to exist anymore. So when you look at it from that perspective, anything we can do here now is just little stuff.
It is, yes.
Compared to what the end of creation is going to be like, it's little stuff.
Yes. And in that light, the capability to destroy the earth is reserved to God alone. Now, again, we can do some things that can render incredible harm on this earth. Again, you go dump a bunch of toxic radioactive material on the ground, it is going to make a bad situation. And perhaps for hundreds of years. It can. But I have seen this earth do some pretty amazing things, too. You know, some of you, many of you, I'm certain, will probably remember the Exxon Valdez spill. Man, that thing was all over the news. Guess what? The earth is recovering from that pretty well. It is. All right? We just had that BP spill out here in the Gulf. Okay? Man, that was a... But, hey, we're all right. You know, we're still alive. All the fish in the ocean aren't dead. Okay? So yeah, we can do some temporary harm to this earth, but folks, we are not going to destroy this earth. God alone will be the one who brings an end to this thing. So does that mean that we are not required to be good stewards of the earth? Of course not. Okay? Again, I learned a very, very valuable lesson from my father that day. All right? And it's a lesson I intend to pass on to my children. All right? As God's children, as followers of God, we are required to be good stewards of this earth. Okay? This is something that God has put into our care. And we've seen passages all throughout the scriptures that talks about the necessity of being good stewards and serving well that which God has given to us. Okay? And not just being foolish with it. And so, I'm not here to say that we can just do whatever we want. But I would just want to offer my personal opinion to caution you to not buy into all the hype. Okay? Our God is in control. Our God is more powerful. When God created this earth and said, let there be, folks, he looked down the road thousands of years and said, we're all going to be driving cars one day. He knows what's going to be happening in the next 6,000 years if we're here. He knows what's going to be happening in the next billion years if this earth is still around then. He knows. And he built this earth to sustain life on it. And so we don't need to be fearful because our Father is in control. Again, that doesn't mean we ought not be good stewards of it. We can't be morons about it and go do stupid and foolish things. As I've said before, I tell my children, you make stupid decisions, be ready to handle the consequences thereof. So do stupid things, bad things happen. And so, Earth is going to continue. God is running the show. God is in control, not us. And just my personal opinion on it, I find it very arrogant when people say that I'm going to destroy the earth. I'm pretty sure God's going to do that. And I'm not going to put myself to say, you ain't got no power over this thing, Lord. All right. My two cents on the matter. Genesis chapter 9, verses 8 through 11. Somebody like to read.
Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you. Of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth, I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood. Neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth.
Thank you. Genesis 9, 12 through 15. Verses 16 through 17.
When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth.
All right, so the rainbow. Folks, we need to take time to enjoy the sight of a rainbow. The rainbow is an awesome thing. They're beautiful, number one. But more importantly than that, it is a sign from God Himself of a covenant that He made with us and also with the animals and living creatures of this earth. You know, I find that interesting. So often we talk about, you know, this book, again, it's about the redeeming of mankind. That's what this story is about. But yet here, God says over and over, I'm making this a covenant between you and the living creatures of earth. Wow. The rainbow's awesome, guys. It is a sign from God. And I love looking at those things. In verse 16, God says, when my bow is in the cloud, I will look upon it, and I will remember my covenant that I have made. It's an amazing thing and a moving thing to think of when the rainbow's there after a rainstorm, we can look upon it knowing that God is too. That's moving to me, folks. The rainbow is a great thing. It's an awesome sign. And we need to take time out to look upon it. Mike?
Coming across 46 across the St. John's one time after a summer storm, and there was a triple rainbow.
Nice.
And a fourth one coming through that, I mean, between the three or four of them, it just filled the whole sky.
Boy, God was really trying to tell you something.
What's God saying here? But it was just breathtaking.
Yeah.
But what it does remind me of is how much God loves people.
Yes.
You think about it, even, you know, He saved, is it eight? Mm-hmm. Take the eight.
Yeah.
He could have just taken them to heaven and been washed His hands of the whole thing.
Yeah.
But He loved people that He killed thousands or millions only for billions of more problem children
yeah.
to come along. But He loves us.
Absolutely.
He loves us that much.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the coolest rainbows I've ever seen. I was at work one day. I just happened to look up, and the sun was directly overhead, and there was an entire rainbow circle around the sun. I have not seen one since that day. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen, but it was awesome. But, you know, the rainbow serves as a beautiful reminder to us of the promises of God, His grace, His mercy, and His faithfulness to us. Just like Mike was just getting at. So I want to suggest to you, when you see the rainbow there, take some time out. Take just a few seconds, a few minutes, look upon it, knowing that your Father is gazing upon it as well. It's something you share with Him, something very physical, very real, that you can share with Him and take sight of. Yeah. Well, I mean, from a scientific point of view, we understand how rainbows are formed, right? The water vapor, sun shining through it, splitting the light into all the different colors and all this. So, but I don't know. I mean, all I know is that the rainbow is a sign from God. This is clearly something that did not exist prior to the flood. I've shared with you that there are a lot of Christian scientists who firmly believe that and from a biblical point of view, it really seems to support that it did not rain. There was no such thing as rain prior to the flood. Okay, if we go and look at Genesis 1 and 2, it talks about how the ground was watered with a mist. And we never hear rain mentioned of until the flood. And so, we can go into a scientific explanation of how it's all there, but what we do know is that God put it there, and it's a wonderful sign to us, and we're cutting ourselves short if we don't take some time just to ponder that when we see Him. And we see Him here a lot in Florida, given how it'll rain for 5 minutes, and but we need to take time out to stop and look at the rainbow, folks, knowing that our Heavenly Father is looking down upon it as well, and to reflect on the promises that God has made, not just about the flood, okay? The thing is that is a covenant that He made, and it is a covenant that He has held faithful to. And if He's holding Himself faithful and honest to that one, how many more will He hold Himself to? God has always been faithful to His promises. If He says something's going to be, it is. If He says He's going to do something, He's going to do it. So we need to take comfort in that. We can learn a lot by looking at the rainbow. All right, antediluvian vegetarians. Betty, you're a vegetarian, right?
Almost.
I thought you were, or around those lines that seemed like I heard. Antediluvian is a big fancy word that I didn't know about until I started going through all this, but it simply is a word that means prior to the flood of the Bible, okay? Genesis 9, 2 through 4, the fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth. This is God talking to Noah after the flood. And on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. If we go back to Genesis chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, God kind of gave a similar speech to Adam and Eve, saying, you know, hey, I want you to take care of this garden, cultivate it, keep it, all this. And then he says, from any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. So when we look at that and we see this here, is it an odd thing for God to explain this to Noah? Does that catch your interest? It caught my interest. I had read this passage, I bet, 1,000 times from the time I was a kid up through my 30s, and I got into a conversation with this about a coworker just a few years ago, and he pointed out to me, and I said, wow, maybe they didn't eat meat prior to the flood. Interesting thought. I just found it really odd that God would go into this great detail to explaining, hey, anything that's alive, it's food for you now. I give all to you, just as I gave the green plant, you know, to Adam and Eve earlier and all. Now I also give you the animals. Only do not eat it with its blood. Just an interesting tidbit. It has really nothing to do with anything important. I just found it interesting. So perhaps they were all vegetarians prior to the flood, but we've seen perhaps the eating of meat came in later on. All right, so disaster strikes. I'm going to try to fly through this real fast. I might actually finish up my slides tonight. Who knows? All right, Genesis 9, 20 through 24. Anybody want to read for me? Quickly, preferably.
And Noah began farming and planting a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and walked backwards to cover the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done.
All right. Why is this story here? Folks, this story is here because the problem of sin still exists. And Mike brought this up last week. I asked him to hold off for a little bit. Mike said last week we were talking about this kind of this idea, and he said, well, yeah, sin was on the boat. And it was. Because there were eight souls on that boat who were very deep in their own sin. Whether they knew it or not, as righteous as they may be, they still had sin. Sin was still very much a problem. And folks, this story is here to tell us that sin still exists and God has to get to the cross. This is one of those pearls. You know, they're in the scriptures, you find all these little pearls and nuggets of stories that are just, man, they pack a punch. A huge punch. You know, we can look at this and say, man, that was just a really weird situation. Okay, Noah got drunk, yet he was naked in his tent, his son... Weird story. But the point that we can take from it, folks, is that sin was still alive and well. It was still our problem. And it was still in desperate need of a solution. God still had to get to the cross. It also gives us insight into the new world of mankind and their relationship to redemption as the nations of Israel and Canaan will affect the rest of the story from this point on. As we get into Abraham and we start seeing how the flow of everything went, Israel and the people of Canaan, the land of Canaan, become big deals. And it all traces back to right here. What happened? Well, problem number one, Noah got drunk. Folks, there is a reason the Bible says over and over and over and over and over and over and over, don't be drunk, don't get drunk, don't get drunk, don't be drunk. There is a reason why. It ain't because God don't want us to have no fun, as people like to charge us all with today. You ever heard people tell you that? Well, God, you Christians don't know how to have fun. Yeah? You know? This is what happens, okay? So, was it just that Ham just walked into Noah's tent and saw him naked? I don't know. But when we look at this, it seems weird. It says that he walked in and saw the nakedness of his fathers, came out and told his two brothers. They walked in backwards with a blanket or something and covered him up. And it says when Noah awoke, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. To me it seems, and this is just Kirk's opinion, Ham may have done something perverse in nature to Noah. Okay? To me, I don't see what the major blow-up is, and if Ham walked into his dad's tent, hey dad, and Noah was passed out and it was disrobed, okay. Susan?
Well, he was the youngest, and it showed a great amount of lack of respect because he basically went out to his brothers to come back and laugh at him.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And they showed respect in what they did.
Yeah, so clearly something really tragic went on regardless of what happened. But we see that Noah curses Ham's son, and I'm almost done here. I only got a couple of slides. Ham curses Ham's son, Canaan, let him be a servant of servants. And then there at the end, that's all we're really told about that story. And then we see here that Noah lived 350 years after the flood. So all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So that brings us to the end of that, and I can't believe it. I actually made it through my slides tonight. this is the first time, I think. So next week we'll talk some about Babel, and also we'll get into an introduction of Abraham. Things are about to start getting really fun now. All right, thank you for your time and attention.